with a little bit of different music. It was actually band music, concert band playing a piece called Tritico, which you undoubtedly have never heard before. I happened to be in the band that played the world premiere back in 1963.
Oh, my gosh.
I was not good enough to play in the band that actually played it, but I was good enough to be able to listen. So anyway, enough of that. This is Dick Paddock with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show.
Doing kind of a tricky lead-in here.
Yes.
Yeah, it's going to keep us on our toes.
Yep. And I'm Dick Paddock, co-host, and sitting across from me is Lorraine Hoyt, our other co-host, both members of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. And in case you missed it, somewhere along the line, this is WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And our guest this evening is Pete McDowell, who I had the pleasure of serving dinner to last evening.
Yeah, that's a friend.
Great stuff.
That's a friend. And he's making my mouth water.
Along with his lovely wife, Mary. And we'll go ahead now and have our interview, and we'll find out the reason that we decided to invite him.
Okay.
At this particular time. And if you'll go ahead, Lori.
Okay, well, we're delighted to be here on WCOM, our low-power station, but it's got a lot of power in its programming, and we're so proud to be part of the WCOM family. We're here every Wednesday night from 5 to 6 p.m., and with our wake-up call, we try to wake you all and ourselves up to the issues of the day, the issues in our community, in our state, and in our nation, all of the above. And we have a person, our guest tonight, Pete McDowell, has been an activist working on these issues. I don't know how many years, but I know it's a powerful plenty of years, and he may tell us.
Early 60s.
It's the early 60s, so that's like 50-some-odd years. And Pete is the former, just recently retired from NC Warren, where he was, what, chief strategist?
Oh, senior strategist.
Senior strategist with NC Warren, which is another one of our favorite environmental organizations that's also been around not as long as Pete.
About 26 years.
And not as long as me, but it's been around, what, how many years?
26.
26 years trying to keep our community and our state in an environmentally sound path.
Nuclear free and lately also
frack-free.
renewable resources.
And
right?
Renewable.
Yeah, very much working against the business plan of Duke Energy, which is basically to keep coal and gas and suppress solar and energy efficiency and run the government while it's at it. So
yeah. Right. So Pete just informed me that he had recently retired. But he wants to talk about, which is pretty exciting, the big picture of what's happening in our state and I guess our nation and what's happening politically and what kind of a big shifts are going on and we want to hear about this.
Well, you've really given me an opportunity, guys, to sort of try to have a early articulation of what's been rolling around in the back of my mind for a long time, and I think all our heads.
Okay.
One way I look at it is when you look back, I mean, we're relatively new into this century.
Mm-hmm.
We look back at the last one, we had the World War One, we had World War Two, we had a myriad of other wars.
Depression.
Huge depression. Myriad of other wars, a Cold War in which we really missed the bullet of nuclear, and that bullet is still there, nuclear annihilation.
And the tail end of that, we had the horrible Vietnam War.
Yeah. And so the question is, looking at this coming century in which everything seems to be on hyperdrive the wrong direction, mm-hmm. and trying to figure out where is the hope that will that civilization will make it through this century.
Yeah.
So that's the question I've been trying to ask myself.
Will we survive?
Yeah. And if so, what has to happen? You know.
Okay.
So, and what I want to sort of just sketch out briefly is just some ideas about a new politics of community and civic engagement, and a paradigm change on how people do democracy, because it totally isn't working. Mm-hmm. And I think we have the coming together of a broad, much more militant and much more connected movement. That's my glimmer of hope. And and people like Naomi Klein, in her book "This Changes Everything," has sort of sketched out what that might look like, but a number of other books have too. Interestingly, I've been reading a novel called by a guy named Colin Back, and it's called Emerging Ecotopia. It was written in 1981, and what it talks about is the kind of organizing and paradigm for organizing as a novel, like a utopian novel, is very close to what I think lines up a lot of things. But let me sort of get into the way I look about this. So I think we're at a time sort of like the early 60s, but I think much more we're in much more trouble. You know, major movements are aligning into a new justice movement. There's a climate justice, economic justice, democracy versus corporatocracy, civil rights movement in a new phase, civil liberties with NASA and all the technology of spying on us and tapping our cell phones and so on at a new phase. And so what is coming, I mean, but that's coming about as a result of critical things happening. And I think a lot of tipping points in people's consciousness are tripping. People are really anxious and upset and have little faith in government. I looked up the polling today. This month's polling on congressional job approval, 14.2% approve. 14.2%. 74% disapprove. And the rest don't have a clue. The right track, wrong track question, is the nation on the right track or the wrong track, is asked every year. Currently, 32% on the right track, 58% on the wrong track. What are people doing? Well, they're spending 5 hours a day watching television, bombarded by hundreds of ads, and an average of 7 hours a day when you're over 65.
Right.
It really?
Happening.
Oh, my
they're,
God.
We are a
Oh, my God.
Atomized.
I'm way behind on my television.
Yeah, me too.
Oh,
my God, it's ketchup time.
Yeah.
That's terrifying.
So just to break it down, just a couple of factoids on the what's happened on money. We know there's a very rapid concentration of wealth. In the paper yesterday, it was talking about Oxfam.
Yes.
The wealthiest 80 billion billionaires, 80 people, control almost the same wealth as half the world's population, 1.9 trillion. Just last year, it was 85 billionaires. You know, it's going to – when do we start doing something? When it becomes 40, 20, 10 when, you know, I mean.
Right. That was more wealth than half of the?
Half of the world's population.
Oh, my gosh.
The figures are so mind-blowing that as people, they feel it, they see it, they sense it, and then they got the figures, and then there's the question of what to do about about it.
It's not just our country. We've been hearing about in our country how it's so skewed and the increasing gap, and yep. that the 1% or even one tenth of the 1%
right.
more than a third or whatever. But this is then worldwide.
This is worldwide.
Yeah,
for our country,
which is even more depressing.
Yeah, for our country, Elizabeth Warren, Senator Elizabeth Warren, says that between the 1930s and the late 70s, 90% of all workers shared 70% of all income growth. 90% shared 70% of all income growth. Between 1980 and 2012, guess how much of that 90% got?
Zero.
Zero. Right. Bingo.
Sorry. Didn't mean to steal your thing.
No.
Yeah, so since the 70s, since the 70s it's been.
Since the mid-80s.
Since the mid-80s, that's when Reagan got
in. No, I'm sorry, since between 1980 and 2012.
That's when the whole paradigm shifted there in terms of the distribution of wealth. It really did.
Yeah.
I don't think a lot of people realize because it started out, you know, sort of slow and you just think, oh, it's a bad year. And,
So what's happening and what happened in 2008 and is set to happen again is that globalization and automation and cyber computer revolution and all that is entails have forced wages down. Demand dries up, and it's only extended by credit. Credit creates bubbles, and the bubbles pop. And very little has been fixed since that scenario happened in 2008. I'm going to talk a little later about what's happening in that. But then in terms of as income concentrates or wealth concentrate, power flows from wealth. You know, you have Citizens United and basically the collapse of all restraint on campaign contributions. I mean, basically any billionaire can give or millionaire can give absolutely as much money as he wants to a candidate. It may have to be a little tricky here or there, but not very tricky.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And
you can buy them with that kind of money. I mean, they can.
Yeah, but why don't we call it what it is? It's bribery.
Yeah,
it's legalized bribery. You're absolutely right.
I'm not so sure how legal it is.
Well,
but
the Supreme Court is saying it is.
Well,
that's what's so depressing.
There was an interesting study last week that looked at the most corrupt states and the least corrupt states, and they use this distinction: real corrupt classic corruption, you know, paper money in paper bags in the men's room, you know, mm-hmm. passed to the men's room, or legal corruption. And legal corruption is special interests.
Writing big checks.
Gives money and get something in return, you know, mm-hmm. that is not right. The public good. That's legal corruption.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, this Wall Street is this was in the paper, I think it was yesterday, citing the New York Times articles that said Wall Street banks and other financial interests have spent $1.2 billion in campaign contributions and lobbying combined, a total that was that was in the last year. That's when Dodd-Frank's, no, they spent the $1.2 billion when Dodd-Frank's was being considered, and they're probably going to beat that the next time the report comes in. $1.2 billion. And Dodd-Frank's has, you know, in the last budget reconciliation bill, they slipped in another way to weaken it.
I mean, and you can see it wasn't the most effective bill, but it had some effect, and they don't want anything to restrain their ability to rip it all off.
To basically play dice with other people's money.
That's right. We, the taxpayers, and Dodd-Frank's tried to put in a few safeguards that we, the taxpayers, wouldn't have to bail them out if they messed it up. It was not very well. It wasn't the best bill, but it was some attempt, and they don't even like that. They want that. We're going to bail them out.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not one of those bankers in jail, except for Bernie Madoff.
He just wasn't as smart as they were, right?
There are fewer major banks. It's consolidated even more. There was a Princeton study recently that the Oligopoly study, and its conclusion was the central point that emerges, this is a quote from our research, is that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on the U.S. government policies. While mass-based interest groups and average citizens have little or no independent influence. They say we're not a democracy anymore, this by any reasonable definition. So, you know, last night we saw the State of the Union thing, that those who could stand watching it, and it was President Obama being very articulate about a kumbaya again and making a bunch of proposals that he never seriously made or seriously pushed, now pushing when there is no chance for them to be passed. And our question is, which party of Wall Street do we want to represent us? And there are distinctions. A lot of us will continue to hold our nose and vote, but we've got to find alternative ways of making democracy work, because a two-party electoral politics at this time, when it can be bought and paid for and controlled by Wall Street, and absolutely is not working. And people are increasingly politics is increasingly unwilling and unable to represent the public good, not only with electoral politics, but the legal system is being undermined totally by the amount that the big boys can spend on the lawyers, contributions to judges. Unions have been decimated. The media is controlled by the media is controlled by about six major companies right now, and 10 or 20 years ago it was like 50 companies. That all the institutions that we've developed to represent the public will or stand up for people in the face of money and power have collapsed, are collapsing. Not all the time, but the tipping point is tipped. And you always have to keep pushing in anywhere that you can try to break through, but we need a new paradigm.
Well, when you talk about the tipping point, I mean, I think it's been a shock to many of us in this state that incremental changes, progressive changes over the many years that people worked and worked for was so proud of, you know, the Racial Justice Act, the expansion of voting rights, all of these things, the education, all of it slowly trying to make it better for the people of this state. And the shock that so many people who come out to Moral Mondays has been how quickly they can absolutely talk about decimate it, rip it apart, throw it away, and in a breathtakingly short amount of time, you see the ruins of years of struggle to make it better.
Very well put. And then, you know, what's happening with racism and now in the police versus the communities is absolutely outrageous. Prison stats, the U.S. again, we have 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prison population. Makes us the world's largest jailer. Since 1970, our prison population has risen 700%, according to the ACLU.
How much?
I was just reading an article just before I came. I haven't finished it yet, and that is that in Florida prisons, there were 326 deaths in the in 1 year, and at least 32 prison guards and officers have been fired.
Jeez.
And that's one state, maybe the worst, maybe not.
Yeah.
Well, were you not shocked? I know I was, because I think of New York State, not thinking of being so bad as it is, about teenagers being in solitary confinement for months.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, yes. And disabled people. You know, I mean, we're talking about what's defined as torture is in our prisons. I mean, we don't have to go to Guantanamo.
We
can just stay on these shores and go to any state, and we're having torture on our citizens in our prisons, and even our young people. Even our kids.
Yeah. And just to go back to the, I think two things that will be huge crises. I mean, you have ongoing crises like the prison system and racism. It's just getting worse. There may be a trigger point prison riot, huge riots or hopefully major investigations or of police. But we just, for example, on torture, we just had the big torture report, mm-hmm. you know, and the accountability for that. Zip.
And how quickly that died down.
Zip.
You know, it was a little bit in the news, but.
Yeah, I saw something interesting that I thought I would never see, and that is that John Yoo apparently bothered to read the report, and when he discovered what they were really doing, he said, I wouldn't have approved that.
I bet he wouldn't.
And I want to take back what I said about New York. What a bad memory, like most Americans I have, where the Attica prison riots under Rockefeller.
Yeah.
It historically, it's not that many years ago. What, 40?
Right.
Or 50 years ago? But I don't know what made me think that New York was better than other places. I take that back, okay?
Yeah. So what I think there are two really absolutely critical sorts of things that are going to happen. First, I think we will have another economic crash within the next 5 years, probably 5 or 10 years. I mean, you've got, because of this huge debt bubble, and humanity now has a mortgage, a world mortgage owes more than three times its income. And it keeps going up all the time. I mean, we're just in the same, doing the same credit expansion with wages stagnant.
And look at our young people's debt. So that they say one of the most important things that we need is consumer spending, is to keep the country afloat. Go spend, even when we're having war. Go to your malls, please spend. And these young people are not going to be able to be buying houses and washing machines or much of anything with the debt that they have and the scarcity of jobs.
They'll get
good paying jobs.
Yeah.
you know, jobs that are not just part-time or
right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, they got credit cards. Somebody will give them credit cards.
they will. They right. bombard them.
So then there's, of course, climate. So
oh, yes.
Yeah. So the climate situation is, you know, the world in the Kyoto protocols and the world meetings on climate and figure that to be safe, we had to keep the rise in temperature under 2 degrees centigrade. Lots of people were saying that was way too high, that still had a lot of risk of runaway climate change. But right now, the emerging consensus is that's not where we're headed. We are headed for 4 degrees centigrade, or that's 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit increase average, which is, when you think average, that is with huge swings in heat waves and droughts and all the rest of it. And the consensus there is that we could be reaching that in 2060, 2070, something on that order. And we don't know. It's very hard to predict when stuff begins to run away. But you get closer and closer to a runaway scenario, the more you push it. I mean, 2% is going to be dire for, you know, much of Africa and Latin America and so on. And, of course, with any of this climate change, there is migration, there is wars, there is all the kind of things that even the Pentagon and the CIA are scared of, right?
They
now.
Are. And I wish those reports were made public to yeah. more people, because if they realize that our government is predicting that, even though some idiots
right.
keep saying, oh, it's not proven.
Yeah.
Well, Obama actually said last night that it's, he's got some friends who are good scientists and he believes them when he's
yeah.
Well, yeah,
says
yeah.
it's running away.
This was the hottest year on record. He said, and 14 of the last 15 years were the last 15 years were the warmest on record. And
right.
You know, hello.
And I love that he quoted the Pope. The Pope, if spiritual if people still have some respect for spiritual leaders, and
yeah.
and I thought it was very interesting that he, because the Pope is about to come out, it's about to be released a whole thing on climate change, and
yep.
a lot of people do pay attention.
That's
one of our little glimmers of hope.
absolutely, yeah. So the the problem is the prospects for the Paris meeting of the international meeting on climate is I think little to none. It just gets more serious and more serious, but it always has to reflect back to local national politics. So
mm-hmm.
what can Obama, even if he wanted to, mm-hmm. commit to with a Congress
mm-hmm.
that doesn't believe in it, is totally
right.
Well, we're going to come back to that. We're now just going to take a break and do a station break.
Yes.
And gather our thoughts for the next half of our show.
Yes, this is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, the Wake Up Call. I'm Dick Paddock, co-host, and Lorraine Hoyt, the other co-host, is sitting across the table from me, and our guest this afternoon is Peter McDowell, who is retiring as senior strategist from NC Warren, and we're listening to his, we hope not dire, predictions.
Well, it's not so much predictions, but sort of,
kind
of outlining.
Extrapolations.
Yeah, outlining where the world, where he sees our political system, where the world is, and where we're headed, and some things that we can maybe have some hope in, but some things we need to be careful about.
Right. And And we're brought to you over the facilities of WCOM LP, Chapel Hill and Carrboro. If you get us out of the air, it's 103.5 FM. If you get us off the internet, it's at wcomfm.org. And we are members of the Triangle Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, an all-volunteer organization, just like the people that operate the radio station, and also of our underwriter, Internationalist Bookstore, at 1,000, I believe it's 1,007 Lloyd Street here in Carrboro, just recently moved in.
And tomorrow night, just looking at my calendar, this is the 21st, right?
Today is the 21st, right.
Okay. Tomorrow night, Thursday, the 22nd, they're having an open house celebrating their move to Lloyd Street, their new digs.
Yeah, that's right. They told us 2 weeks ago.
That's right.
And Katie was here. Yeah.
Yeah, and we've both been busy with many things almost slipped our mind, but we didn't let it slip our mind, not really.
Yeah.
And what is it? It starts at 5, I think?
Yeah.
5 to?
5 to probably 7 or so.
Or 8, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry that we're a little imprecise, but go stop by.
Right.
Yeah, go have some supper at Weaver Street, walk around the corner to Lloyd Street, give congratulations to the Internationalist Bookstore and Community Resource Center.
And the Internationalist Bookstore has a website, of course, internationalistbooks.org. And we have a website that is the Triangle Women's International mm-hmm. League. It is triangle.wilpf.org.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of stay tuned announcements. Following us at 6 o'clock will be Chris Fitzsimon of NC Policy Watch with his weekly news and views, somewhere to the left of, I don't know, Sean Hannity. But he doesn't deal with the stuff that Sean Hannity does. He's very much dealing with North Carolina issues.
Yes.
And also, we want to let you know that next week on our show, we will have C.J. Suit of the Sacrificial Poet.
That's right, and I'm so excited.
Yeah, it's been a little bit of a battle getting him to come.
He was out of town for quite a while, and he's been busy and working with all these young people and doing such good stuff. And so we're going to have poetry, a poet. It's going to be so wonderful next week. And
right.
And we're just thrilled.
Yep. And so that's it. Back to you, Lori and Pete.
So now I was going to – now I get to talk a little bit about the possible glimmers of hope.
Yes, the glimmers of hope.
And what the particular challenges
are. We've outlined the reason that things look so dire in many ways, politically, with all the wars – climate change, these are things that we're very concerned about. So we're anxiously wanting to hear some glimmers of hope.
So I think there's two pieces of the problem. One is, how do people see themselves as agents of change? And second is, what do they find for levers of change? What can they build for levers of change? So, you know, what capitalism does and is doing with increasing in efficiency is selling us our identity. You know, mm-hmm. we are our brand. You know, mm-hmm. I carry an Apple and I have a whatever the hell. Yeah.
Yeah. I drive a this. Or,
yeah, right.
Yeah.
And so in that we are our brands, our lifestyles, and then we're moving, and that gives us a continuum to move up from a, you know, Audi to a whatever the hell. I mean, mm-hmm. you know. And we become atomized consumers that don't know how to talk to each other about anything other than that stuff and sports, you know?
Yeah.
And because everything else is sort of we're afraid to talk about. And we have to work on and talk about a new kind of identity and kind of group identity. And identity, I had this real interesting discussion with the former chair of the anthropology department at UNC who studies identity. And she says identity is we have multiple identities, but they are formed in our groups. They're reflections of who we are is who we are with and how we see ourselves with other people.
Mm-hmm.
But increasingly, families are broken down and scattered. Mm-hmm. You know, I got one daughter in D.C. and one in Portland, Oregon, and you got one in Chicago and one in Portland, and
Durham,
yeah, right, and you know, it's so our keeping families, the whole extended family sort of thing is totally broken down. So what are our? Do we just have peer groups that we have to have groups and networks and an identity and education. The most important thing is groups in which we can actually have conversations about this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that is very rare and very hard. And there are very few models in our culture for doing that. And I think we have to model that. We have to figure out how to model that and have to bring more and more people into those conversations. In the small groups that in the 60s we called affinity groups and that, mm-hmm. that sort of thing have to network and experiment with a whole variety of other ways of making change, and that mm-hmm. from everything from nonviolent protest to
well, the women's consciousness raising groups.
Yeah. I mean, all that sort of things, but with a real intention of we've got to connect the issues, we've got to connect the movements, we've got to connect the networks,
mm-hmm.
and we've had the problem of ceding our agency to nonprofits, and I've worked in nonprofits all my life, but nonprofits do a lot of good and do facilitate those conversations. But the nonprofits, but the people themselves have to pull their agency back together and say, what can we do to go around, dramatize the kind of change we have to be, and. We have to be talking about our tap into our emotions and our spirit and our political action and have the conversations that go that whole range, because we are so fragmented, compartmentalized, and any talk about feelings, doubts, depression, any of that sort of thing is risky, verboten, you know.
Well, do you see, like, the more what Reverend Barber's trying to do with Moral Monday is just one model of trying to pull together disparate people with different issues to come together and try to realize that they have some power in unity?
I think it's a good experiment in bringing a lot of issues together. I think it's still based on the notion that we have to get out and vote. The question is, for who? For whom? You know, if Democrats are not going mm-hmm. to, first of all, you know, we had Democrats for most of the rest of our lives. Where was poverty? What did they do about poverty? What did they do about environment? What did they do?
Mm-hmm.
Damn little, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if Democrats got back in the state house right now, the state would be run by Blue Cross Blue Shield, Duke Energy, the Chamber of Commerce, and the developers.
Right. In other words, not much difference, except maybe Art Pope wouldn't be in there.
Yeah, I mean, there would be difference along the edges of some of the victories that we've had and really had to push for over the years. But there's small stuff compared to the big, relatively small and cultural stuff, as opposed to the big economic, climate, and racial sorts of progress that we've got to be making. One fascinating book I've just read or heard was by Russell Brand. Now, Russell Brand is the English comic and working class comic.
Yes.
And a wild guy who you know, grew up poor in Britain and became a heroin addict, and then became a famous comic, and he became addicted to everything else he could buy.
Right.
And then he got into really struggled to figure out what was going on, and got into meditation and yoga mm-hmm. and political action. And he was on a famous interview with the equivalent of Hardball, Chris Hedges, or you know, sort of the English
Chris Matthews.
Yeah, Chris Matthews. Yeah, and the guy said he said, "I don't vote. I've never voted, and I see no purpose in voting because the parties are essentially the same, you know." And the interviewer, well, smart guy, how are you going to make change? And he said, well, I haven't got all those answers, but I'll get back to you. So he wrote the book. And the book is...
What's the name of the book?
Revolution.
Of course, I should have guessed that.
It's a hoot, but it's also very profound in linking our vacuum that we feel in our souls in terms of connection with other people and what we're doing in life and nature and all that sort of thing with action, with political action and the experimentation that has to go on. And we have you know, one of my dreams is to find a website someplace that if nothing else, that once a morning from someplace you would have a 2-minute excerpt on here's something that folks in wherever, Botswana or Vermont or Texas, have done that was a protest, or they did a kind of community garden, or they took over the local government. Local government is, I think, one place we can still be fairly creative. But and the people get inspired and networked, and because I think the power of small groups doing stuff, networking and sharing the examples is what we have to – that's the area we have to be mining. And linking our identity as activists. I mean, I grew up and you guys grew up probably at about the same time in a movement, and we became – our purpose in the world is to make positive change, and have been working at it as best we could ever since, you know. And we need a whole new generation of doing that. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, a recent poll of the millennial generation found that 50% of them said they preferred socialism to capitalism. That's kind of a change. I'm not sure they know what that means. But
well, I'm sure they know what capitalism means.
Yeah, right. But they've
identified the enemy.
They've identified the enemy, and now...
And they haven't been afraid of the word socialism, which so many older people equate it foolishly with communism, you know, or whatever. Yeah. They don't know either what it means.
Right. So I think that we're sort of in a pre-movement stage. We have pieces of movements going on all the time. You know, from the Moral Monday movement to the I Can't Breathe movement to Occupy. Several years ago, there's trigger points that happen. People get together. Increasingly, there's solidarity kinds of stuff happening along with it, and our job now is to make the examples of sort of cross divides conversations about this stuff that goes deep and goes broad at the same time, and then that models for other groups and other people, and connecting what other groups and other people are doing that way. And then I think when another financial collapse or another major move, a war, a cyber attack that brings down all the banks, you know, who the hell knows? I mean, that could happen.
Yeah.
We then it becomes a bigger combination trigger event that people will react to. And then, I mean, that's what happened with the Occupy movement. Who, the, you know, kindling gets so dry in a period like that, and it's so obvious what's happening, you know, the 1%, that people came together. I mean, they hadn't thought it out. There wasn't, it, you know, I mean, we hadn't thought it out, and we tried to think it out, and it was the model had problems, but lots of people who were involved in it are still still working on change.
And they did. They did change the national conversation,
absolutely,
which had been absolutely saturating the airwaves about our debt. And the conversation, that was the beginning of a real nationwide change of the conversation about inequality.
Yeah.
You know, that was when it began. And Occupy, I give them credit for them getting that conversation changed. And that was a big thing to do. And you're right, people who were involved in Occupy are still carrying on their involvement in other ways.
Yeah, I mean, that those brief movements and brief periods of action are not dead ends.
No.
You know, people get more and more, they understand, it helps change their identity. It helps change who they
mm-hmm.
who they respect.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that I really like that's happening is you have more and more books and podcasts that are getting this kind of stuff from you know, Amy Goodman to Dmitry Orlov, who was a Russian who watched the collapse of the Soviet Union, and was called, and his book is The Five Stages of Collapse or Reinventing Collapse. And he's brilliant and a funny writer, and says how and really emphasizes the importance of community resilience, of building communities, mm-hmm. of building smaller communities that people can rely on.
And what, Dmitry who?
Orlov, O-R-L-O-V. Oh. There's a podcast that's there are a bunch of them, but there's one that one of the guys who runs it works at Duke, but it's called The Extra Environmentalist. It's like looking at the environment. It's not about the it's about the environment, but it's about the economy and everything we've been talking about. It's mm-hmm. the big picture and how it fits together, and it's a like a two-hour interview show, and it's great.
Well, and remember that, though, I'm forgetting the name of the author, but The Great Turning, that David Corden, and that's exactly what he was saying back then, that there's a three-legged stool, and that it is going to collapse at some point, and it was peak oil, and it was the economy, and it was climate change.
Yeah.
And that these three things were moving towards collapse at some point, and that we needed to have small communities of conscious people consciously preparing for that, so that it didn't become total, you know, people in gated communities shooting down the rest of us starving people at the gates there, that we started preparing ourselves.
Right, and with peak oil, we have peak oil volatility, right? We basically have an oil war going on right now. You know, in which the Saudis are trying to really hurt Iran and Russia and the shale oil business and so on. So it's a very atypical sort of thing, which I don't know how long they can keep it up. But we're going to have, you know, I mean, I like to read things like Business Week or Fortune.
That's what somebody told me recently, that if you want to know what's going on, don't be reading all your political magazines and stuff. You need to be reading, you know, what the oil industry's putting out, where they want pipelines, where, you know, Business Week, these things that we on the left don't think of reading, but that's where we find out what the enemy is planning.
Yeah, and keep up to the minute with the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
As long, don't read the editorial
pages. Oh, God, don't. Yeah.
But read the fact-based stuff, and they will get it right, because that's their bread and butter.
That's right. It seems to me their opinions are seeping more and more into their reporting. But
so I don't want us to lose track. So yep. We're talking about glimmers of hope, and this is.
I'm saying that the glimmer is there's a paradigm change
mm-hmm.
because people feel it mm-hmm. first they feel it.
Yes,
and you look around right now and. We have an apocalyptic culture. How many people are wearing skulls or that's almost a death cult going around. I see a 9-year-old with a skull on his. What's going on? And and in the songs there's they feel it. It's an attitude that becomes a negative life. Evaluation,
mm-hmm.
But there's more to the extent that they see, like the collapse in the banks that wants to occupy people. More and more get to see the target. The more they see black young men killed by white cops and so on, within very suspect circumstances, they increasingly get that. When they see this crazy right-wing denial on climate change, they say, well, wait a minute.
And I think even people who are, whether conservative or whatever, I think people feel this unease. Going back to that earlier statistic you quoted about that the people who think the country's in the right direction, it's gone from where it's now 30, only around 31% thinks in the right direction, and 58 think it's going in the wrong direction. I think people know something's very wrong,
yeah.
But they don't quite know what to do about it.
They're. I think that we're going to have a serial throw whoever's in office out, sort of. going out.
Yeah.
And people, the Democrats have been able to talk a much better line, just never produce, because their money comes from the same guys. That they,
mm-hmm.
Well, part of the problem is that when the Republicans get in, they do such a bad job. Half of what the Democrats are doing is cleaning up the mess.
Yeah,
maybe more than half what they're doing.
Yeah, that's true, and that's where we always get caught. Like the Republicans managed to look so bad and be so bad, really be bad,
right?
In terms of caring about the poor, caring about kids or whatever, that you feel like the Democrats, I'll hold my nose, but at least they will try.
Well, I'm not sure they'll try. Some will, some won't.
Yeah, yes. Actually, there's always. I will. For a glimmer of hope, there's always been, and even if they're Republican, some people who have some integrity in there. Otherwise, we would have collapsed a long time ago. They're like keeping the finger in the dike. They're trying to keep the thing afloat and keeping some integrity going, but. But it's fewer. Too many of them have too much money. They're all millionaires now.
But we can't. We've got to give up giving our agency, our vote.
I hear you.
Right.
Yeah.
To them.
Yeah.
We've got to take it back to ourselves.
Yeah.
With people we trust and with groups who agree with it and make it happen locally first.
Yeah.
And find other ways to make it. We've got to reclaim our agency, reclaim and rebuild our communities, families, and that sort of thing, because it's going to be a rocky road, and it's getting rocky right now.
One of the things that I've seen recently is that some people are predicting that the collapse is going to be in March.
March.
Yeah. March of what year?
This year, 2 months from now.
Oh.
Why are they saying March?
What?
I don't know. Some arcane guy watching the price of gold.
I think there's one of those for every month. But
how long the fur of the llama is right now? Or
right.
Yeah.
This is the only specific prediction I've seen.
But granted, that probably it will not happen this March. I think what Pete's talking about, and I think what we're all worried about, is that unless there's some drastic changes, we are moving to all kinds of collapse with the economy. We're heading. I mean, as I saw the thing going up, the numbers going up for the Dow report. You know, I just thought, this is getting very bubbly. You know, this is.
They're just printing money.
Just printing the money, where they keep giving the banks 0% interest, but they're having the young people 8% interest, you know, for their student loans. And I'm thinking, you know, this country is stark raving mad. You know, it really is, if they think there's going to be any kind of an economy. And then I realize when they want these big trade deals, it's because we won't have a middle class here. Oh, we got all these Indians and Chinese to sell it to. They don't care about having I used to think there has to be a middle class. No, not if we're going to have all these global trade deals. You know, so it's very scary. It's very scary, right, what's happening. And but I'm glad you're giving us some glimmers of hope.
I keep looking for them.
I guess I've been putting a lot of hope in the Pope. I've left the church many, 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 many years ago. But he certainly and that's the other thing in terms of small groups. Churches could.
Yeah.
Could play a role in that.
And sometimes do.
There are some churches that do play that role as a gathering place for diverse people to come and have these kind of conversations that, Pete, you're outlining we need to have.
And we need to have them quick because...
because we have to follow on with the action right away quick.
Yeah.
Well, Angela Davis said, you know, whenever there's like these movements get started, like right now, I Can't Breathe and Black Bodies Matter, we've got to kind of support because there's where people are paying attention and out of these, you know, we don't know where it can go, and it can go in some good directions.
Right.
Because I think we have to keep hope alive. We do. Yeah. Otherwise, you want to stay home and drink more wine and watch that 7 hours of TV. Okay, come next week. We're going to have a poet who keeps hope alive. He works with young people.
Right.
And the young people, they know something's going down wrong. They are very much into apocalyptic kinds of books and ideas. So we got to give them the kind of hope. And C.J. Sewitt keeps hope alive with poetry. And that's what we need, the arts.
Hello? Hello? Anybody?
Hello?
There? Hello?
I can barely hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. This is Michael Wade. I was going to ask the lady if...
We're going to have...